what percentage of the viewing population experiences how much grief? Which is the lesser of two evils here? If everybody out at the horizon is suffering when you use the pill antenna, and the people enclosed become happy, as opposed to a small percentage of the population enclosed not quite as happy without the pill antenna, but everyone on the horizon is happy, you see where I'm going here? K2EJ, K2LIW.
Yes, I see where you're going, but you know what? I'm only 3 long miles from the building, and I'm not happy. I happen to be north and east of it, and there's a couple of stations I can't get, no matter how hard I try, unless I put a seventh generation equalizer on the box. And even then, when there's a little bit of a reflection from plane going by or something like that, it's bye-bye TV. So I actually think that you know, the people in Staten Island and the people in Brooklyn were getting reception, but at the time that they made their measurements, they only had third generation equalizers. So I really think that they really ought to go back to their original complements of the four bays, what they had before they started making this change with the backfill that came down at Brooklyn and Staten Island, and eliminate the problem, because I've talked to some people in Brooklyn that have exactly the same problem, even though the signal may be stronger, but that other signal is there. And by the way, I figured 300 feet of pipe was something like 20-something nanoseconds worth of distance. And don't forget, one complete symbol is 97 nanoseconds, and if it was displaced by one whole symbol, the receivers would probably have less of a hard time. K2RIW, K2J.
Yeah, I got a slight challenge on you there, Eric. In free space, the speed of light is very close to 1 nanosecond per foot. In cable, it's likely to be slower.
Ooh,
waveguide. It was waveguide at best, yes, but in phase delay. If it's coaxial cable we're talking about, it's a delay line, 300 feet of it would give you 500 nanoseconds. You don't need 300 feet of it. Back to you on that one.
And I've also calculated the time period for one cycle. And that's what I use as my reference point. I didn't take the velocity of cable into consideration. I'm just talking about difference in frequencies. And I should revisit that. Because I did do another calculation with the cable velocity. But you're right about that. The velocity of the cable is relatively slow. But, you know, it is a constant factor when you have everything running through a piece of cable. You're going to a power divider, and it keeps the antenna through the same length of fact. It all comes out at the same time.
Okay, so if I go back about three transmissions, I believe you were stating that the main path to the three bays versus the path to the backfill has approximately 300 feet of physical cable difference. That would suggest if they were TEM kinds of cables, they couldn't be less than 300 nanoseconds of difference. Their waveguide, now when we talk about the difference, we got to talk about group delay versus phase delay. And to try to make that all come out right, when you flip over to coax, I think it becomes difficult. But if there really was 300 feet of cable difference between the two antenna systems there for the power divider, that would suggest in the vicinity of 300 nanoseconds of delay is required, which might be 210 feet of coaxial cable. And I'm worried now, if one of them is waveguide and the other one is delaying the coax, you've now got an dispersion problem to account for. Without a fancy equalizing filter to take out the dispersion, life's going to get complicated. K2EJ, isn't it always K2LAW? 2EO,
Zink.
Eric, first grade, Eric.
No, I don't know if there's 300 feet. That's kind of like my guess, because consider this. The combiner's on the 864. They added a power divider in the waveguide end there. But originally, the output of the combiner, which is a series of cavities, that fed a 6-inch piece of coax, which is 6-inch diameter copper pipe. It's that heavy, thick stuff. And that went up to the mooring mast where the antennas are mounted. Now they put in the waveguide side of it, this power divider, another button, and then some more coax that goes, and I believe it's 6 inch, but I don't actually know, I'm going to find out. And that goes from the 86th floor to the base of the antenna, which is sitting about the 84th floor. So it's a relatively short run in relation to what goes to the antennas on the mooring net. So that's where my guess is. I mean, it could be more than 300 feet. It could be less than 300 feet. But I can't imagine that they put the appropriate amount of 6-inch pipes somewhere to make it match. Plus the fact that they split it at the waveguide end, rather than where the power divider is up in the mooring mast that splits between the panels and the antenna.
Okay, one more time now. Which is the longer piece of cable right now? The one going to the main mast? I think the answer is yes. The one going to the backfill, I think, is the shorter one. The backfill, is that the one that needs the highest amount of power? It can tolerate more insertion loss. Therefore, if we add more cable to the backfill, doesn't that make everything happy both in power and time delay? Over to you, Eric.
Well, if you duplicate what's going up to the other antenna, yeah, everything's going to be equal. I mean, you know, in the analog world, we didn't think of that. What we did was, in the analog world, we could stand a little bit of a ghost, you know. I mean, a microsecond was the delay between the main edge of the picture and the ghosting edge of the picture. It can get a little bit annoying, but it's not all that bad. So all we basically did was we were just concerned that the antennas were in phase in terms of a CW wave, in terms of if you had 0 degrees coming out of one antenna, it doesn't matter whether it was, 10 wavelengths later as long as it was 0 degrees coming out of that other antenna. But in the digital world, you can't play that game. Go ahead, Richard.
Yeah, I'm not sure with digital, but what I was thinking was, could he use on the shorter antenna a lower velocity cable and a faster velocity cable on the longer run to pull him back into some sort of phase relationship? Like maybe on the shorter antenna, something with a 0.5 or a 0.6 velocity factor and get up to 0.75 on the long one. Pull it over to the next cycle. I don't know if you can do that on
video. I can't go to the next cycle. I think I know what you mean. Next cycle of digital data. They can't do that. Next cycle, RF-wise, we're now doing kind of electronic steering. Got to be careful on that one. First of all, his 6-inch line going up to the main antenna is air-filled or dry nitrogen-filled or sulfur hexafluoride-filled. That's running at 0.97 velocity factor, if you ask me. Therefore, the backfill antenna is the one that could be using lower velocity factor cable, but almost all the techniques I know of for making lower velocity factor have more insertion loss. I'd rather just coil more cable on the ground or in the laboratory, so to speak, on the 83rd floor or wherever it is, just coil more cable. And I think that's a way of making it come out right. I guarantee this is all going to come out right eventually. Another quick question I've got for you, Eric, is that I've been fortunate to get a hold of a November 24th, 19-8 issue of an MSW document entitled ATSC VSB Transmission System Seminar Notes by Gary. Do I have a later version that you've got, or you already got that particular version? This particular document is 2.5 inches thick, 8.5 by 11, double-sided. Over to you, Eric.
It's bound with that plastic thing.
It's a big 10-4, everybody. It's a big black plastic thing with a zillion fingers to it, which if I dropped it on the floor, would probably fly apart. Go ahead.
I think I have that. I think that's the latest version.
That's a very nice introduction to how to evaluate the various phenomena. What does all this jazz mean? He even explains decibels. It gets very basic, and then all of a sudden,
Mass Basic. Over to you, Eric.
I'm not sure if I've seen what you're talking about. So anyway, can I call him up and ask him? I'm going to actually forward this email to him and get his opinion on the whole thing. Well, you're up at 3 o'clock in the morning and you've got a visit over too. You might try turning and re-scanning through Channel 13 if you didn't get him before, you're going to get him now, that's for sure. Anyway, back to you, Dick. You got any other thoughts or questions, let me know, but I don't mean to be the monopolistic one here. K2RW, KE2J.
Can I have a quick question for Eric when you're done?
You sure can. Now, this is the Digital Television Network. It used to be called the Tech Net. Go ahead, I think it's the Century Yoga right ahead.
Eric, I'm wondering, probably like you say, it's the way it's marketed. The gentleman in PC Vision said 120 cycle technology just available over 40 inches. I bought a 37 inch Samsung, which is being delivered tomorrow. It's a 1080, it's capable of 1080p. With the 60 cycle refresh rate, is there any concern about, like you're talking about trailing edges, if I'm watching a Blu-ray here, if I'm going to be buying a Blu-ray player? In other words, should I cancel the order and go the extra mile to 40 inches to get the 120 cycle refresh rate? Because the difference was a fair amount of money. Yeah, Eric.
All right, let me give you a couple things. First of all, you shouldn't buy anything without looking at it, all right? There's a couple of issues that you really need to see, because a lot of the stuff that I'm talking about, you're not going to see with your eyeballs. Or at least, it'll annoy the heck out of me, but you won't notice it. So, look, there's definitely advantage to a high refresh rate stuff. There's no question about it. If you're into watching movies, you know, and you're really into it, you know, and it's fast-moving stuff, then it's worth it. If you're into football games, it'll be like, well, why did I buy this other way? That's the significance and the difference. But the reality is that, okay, if you go look at stuff in the store, which is a problem because the selection of material is usually pretty poor, that's one thing, and you go look with your eyeballs and see what you like and see what's pleasing to you and what has what you consider to be good colorimetry. If you're just satisfied with whatever you see, then, you know, that's fine. Let me drop. There's also another reality, and that is that not everything that's broadcast is broadcast in high definition. A lot of stuff you'll see is 4x3. Now, you have the choice on a set of stretching it out or you know, losing what's on top and bottom and keeping the same aspect ratio, which I don't really recommend. Some people do that to prevent the dark areas on the sides from burning in. But what you're doing is you're relying on the internals of the receiver or the tuner to take that 4x3 525 signal and blow it up into 1080i or 720p. And how well the device you bought does that can make you either really annoyed when you're watching standard stuff or quite happy because it does a good job. There's a lot of things to look at, so, you know, I couldn't give you an answer and say cancel that order and go pick up the other thing. What you really need to do is, you know, have done your homework and decided about what it is that you want to see. K2RW, K2J. Let me ask you this, though, Eric. You seem to be somewhat concerned on how 4x3 is going to be displayed. Beyond March, let's say, of 2009, will there be very much further? They're not going to be transmitting two high-def channels. They'll be transmitting one high-def channel and a couple of standard definition channels. Most of your legacy educational material and old shows and stuff like that, they're going to be 4x3 because you're not going to stretch them to death and make the people either look fat and skinny, you know, fat and short, or tall and skinny, you know, depending upon which way you want to stretch it out, or lose the top and bottom of the head and feet. So 4x3 is going to be around for quite a long time. It's not going anywhere. Back to you, Dick.
4x3 on my 16x9 screen, and I letterbox it, which I now means I've got the black bars long as the screen is sufficiently modern in engineering. Liquid crystal, I don't think, burns in. I believe plasma does. Old plasma does. But the new plasmas, I think, have less of that. If I stop worrying about this burning of the black areas of the screen, I don't think I'll get away that much on a modern set. Am I wrong on that one? With you, Eric, K2LIW?
K2LIW, K2J. Well, the biggest culprit with screen burning, of course, is the CRT. For example, you'll find some people's TV sets that, let's say they just have it on PBS, you see the 13 logo burned into the plasma. Well, you get that effect in the plasmas. The new plasmas don't do it as badly, but they do it. The reason why is that you're energizing gas and you're actually changing the, even though it's a inert gas, the gas leaks, there's a lot of things that happen. There's also a little phosphor that works with the gas, and that constantly is being hit by electrons. As you knock those electrons off and make the phosphors light up, of course, you wear it, if you want to call it that. A similar process happens in the gas plasmas that don't have phosphors in it. They also leak, they get hot, etc., etc., so on and so forth. Most people aren't aware that the life of an average plasma TV is only 10,000 hours. KQRW, KE2J.
Okay, plasma 10,000 hours. Old plasma has a little bit more burn than the new plasma. I think there is essentially no burn-in characteristic of LCD. Here I'm guessing. 85% of the large screen sets right now are LCD. I'm guessing that percentage will persist for some time to come. If LCD has no burn-in, I think the only aging characteristic I get of LCD is whether or not the cold cathode fluorescent tube burns out, and I'd like to believe that's a replaceable item. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW,
K2EJ,
you don't know how many fluorescent tubes I've replaced in my life so far. And some of them, they don't even make replacement parts, so they just want you to go buy a new monitor. But when it comes to the big sets, you can get parts for them. But more and more we're moving away from the cold cathode fluorescent tubes and moving into OLEDs, or organic LEDs, the light source. And the reason for that is that better quality control over the spectral response. Most liquid crystals look okay, but we don't like to use them for color standards because they're not really very good. But if you were looking, put a liquid crystal up against a high quality CRT, you can adjust and make the CRT very, very precise and control the emission of the phosphor very precisely. When you're looking at a liquid crystal, you're relying on a multispectral white light source that is not pure white. It's got bands of energy in it. And you're relying on a filter that sits behind the liquid crystal to make the colors for you, which is a plastic in its dye, or it's a metallized dye, or it's a dichroic surface, which changes over time. K2RIW, K2J.
Okay, so the new kinds of illumination have got definite spectral lines to them. I suspect they have a lot longer life. In other words, light-emitting diodes, I think, have a longer life than any cold cathode or hot cathode fluorescent tube. But let's backtrack now. We've been reasonably happy with the color response we get out of the so-called white light of a cold cathode fluorescent tube. That's the usual source of limitation of many of the flat screen televisions and flat screen computer screens that we're using. Have they intentionally made that item very non-replaceable? Does it have 10,000 hours of life also? You've replaced a few of them. I guess that you better work pretty hard to do it. I know that in the case of a laptop, replacing that illumination source is a dog of a problem. There, I'm going to agree with you. But I'd like to believe on the larger object, that's a, let's say a 40-inch display television set for my living room, I'd like to believe that that light source is easier to display, easier to replace. Maybe I'm being naive. What do you, Eric? Can't you LAW?
All the larger displays, the light sources are replaceable. They're all replaceable. It's a matter of how goes up to the plate that, because the light source in the larger display is a multiple light sources and not a single two. Even your computer monitor. Now, your laptop is a royal pain to replace, but usually it's cheaper to just buy the whole damn display and replace it than to try and change the tube for that. But the big guys, tubes come off separately. I mean, if you want to talk about taking 1,000 screws out, there's a place to do it. You can get replacement parts for them. The organic LEDs last light years longer than the cold cathode tubes do. And they don't change their colorimetry over time like the cold cathode tubes do. And I don't particularly like the way LCDs look, to be quite honest, but it's acceptable for people. Unfortunately, with the roadhouse laws the way they are, you ain't going to see no 302s anymore. But the EFT, they're coming. They're coming. After telling a couple of CEOs, and so I suspect another 6 months they'll actually be here. It's RWK 2J.
Okay, I'm hearing an extremely noisy NJO, I think it was. Hopefully you can up your power and go ahead with your question. Okay, maybe, okay. Also, I'm kind of curious if Ken, the B5DJB, are you with us tonight? Link open, Eric, so that Ken would have the ability to get in if he wanted to?
Yeah, I see he's locked in. He's there. I think he's listening or not at the moment because, you know, he is a busy guy.
That's for sure. When is the liquid, the light-emitting diodes and the organic version of them with phosphors and whatever that you're not as happy with? I know they've got very specific spectral lines coming out of there. You're not happy because they're a little bit too bluish. Is that what happens? And that's question number one. And question number two, as the cold cathode fluorescent tube starts fading, does it become too red? Again, I guess on my part.
Eric is right. The country could be the size of the state of New York, or the size of New York and New Jersey. So you can go 200 miles, you go 300 miles, and you're into another country. You travel 1,100 miles, and you've gone to two countries. So there, that kind of operation where they're using, like, you know, multiple sites would work, but, you know, our country is so much spread out there.
By the way, there is no more analog in many European countries at this point.
Well, I haven't been there in 10, 11 years. Just I have a question. You know, Eric, I've always answered, but no one's ever been able to answer this question, is why are the AM broadcast is 9 kilohertz steps and here at 10 KC? No one's ever been able to tell me who and why, except in political.
Tradition. I bet you a lot of it's tradition. I think England has 8 megacycles to their television channel, and we have 6. They got 625 lines, we got 525 lines. They got 25 frames to our 30 frames. Our field. Our frames. At least when it comes to the 25 and the 30, I can explain that one because they've got 50 hertz power, we got 60 hertz power. And the sound bars, it would be the bars from imperfect filtering of the power would be drifting across the screen, would be annoying if there wasn't synchronization between the two. So I sort of understand that one.
Not really the case.
Okay, tell me.
Alright. Why it comes up as 50 actually goes back to the beginning of television. And that has to do with building vertical and horizontal oscillators and the ability to flywheel an oscillator. Because essentially what you're going to do is you're going to phase lock an oscillator to this incoming pulse. Okay? And what easier way is there to phase lock in the days of the fourth phase lock loop to phase an oscillator than to use the line frequency as a reference because it was the most stable thing that they wanted to have. It wasn't because of the humbug. It was actually because, if you think about the early oscillators, how you would make them lock to a frequency and stay in phase is the reason why
Okay, I had a whole series of emails with a buddy of mine in the United Kingdom a year or two ago. And one of the things that was amazing to me is that the United Kingdom, I think, is not on the European grid. I think a little bit of it shares power from time to time with the cable that goes across the English Channel into France. But for the most part, the United Kingdom is thoroughly independent. In the United States, our power is 60 hertz. And that 60 hertz is, to my knowledge, standards in technology. And their rubidium or cesium being standard. So our 60 hertz is extremely accurate. However, in the United Kingdom, their 50 hertz goes to a slightly lower frequency during the day when it's under heavy loading, and they compensate by going to a slightly higher frequency at nighttime to make sure that their clocks don't gain and lose time. They do not keep their 50 hertz thoroughly synchronized to a standard. And I checked and rechecked that, and a buddy of mine works for the British television network, British DQ, what is it called now? their equivalent of the FCC or their, whatever it's supposed to be. You got it. And I wonder if you've heard something similar along those lines, Eric. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, there's actually a lot of stories that some of the guys in the BBC would tell me about there. It's a 4 or 5 wire system, the crystal palace. How it was so wide frequency dependent. But yeah, that's from what I understand, they're not on the European national grid, and they walk all over the place. They used to walk all over the place. They don't walk as much, you know, walk that far. As far as television is concerned, it's just a reference to get you going, and once you love it, you just keep grabbing it every field, and, you know, make your little corrections. So, as far as saying lack of a traditional sense, you can think of it as an athlete with a sampling hole. So that's how that originated. But all of Europe had different standards. Now, most of the Europeans are on digital and have turned the analog off. And it's a universal standard. It's actually what we call BVB. And they use that standard. BVBT is their standard. T standard for terrestrial. And it's universal throughout Europe. So at least now there's only two different standards, and that's 6. But the Chinese did develop their own HDTV standard, which is different from everybody else, because they wanted to be different. K2IWK should get.
Back in the days of analog television, where you had 525 line, 625 line, NTSC, PAL, and CCAM, and you had the audio 4.5 meg, and audio 3.75 meg, and prominence of 3.575 double sideband suppressed carrier, independent sideband, I would call that, vector modulation, and different chrominant subcarriers, different audio subcarriers, and different ways of transmitting digital and data and whatever over the audio channel. There were at least 14 different kinds of analog television in the world a few years ago. Now when it comes to digital television, when it comes to 1090, 720, 480, just talking about the line, progressive versus interlaced, 8 VSD, 4 VSD, 2 VSD, 16 VSD, whatever. We got a lot of different possibilities for different kinds of digital television within the 8 VSD versus the COFDM. It looks like it's expanding. By the way, I should jump over to this one too. We are going to go back to Joe, who wants to talk about portable digital television. And you've given us a little bit of a hint in the past about laptop and/or cell phone television, which I think was going to be either 2 or 4 VSD in order to use less bandwidth, give you a little bit less resolution, but can still give a pleasing picture while you're in motion. Can that 2 and 4 VSD be transmitted simultaneously with the 8 VSD on the same frequency region? I think the answer is no. But I bet you there's some kind of a way of getting both at the same time. KE2EJ, KE2LIW.
KE2LIW, KE2EJ. You should go listen to last week's conversation. The answer is yes. If you remember, I kind of described it as, I couldn't think of the word constellation. I don't know why my brain went blank, so maybe that's what I'll remind you. But think of a constellation. Think of, in the case, just to make a pure example, think of QPSK. And that's basically a core
Yep, he did say it, and I'm now beginning to believe it. Joe's got some further comments. I bet you he's run some experiments already on digital television while in motion. Let's see what he's done. So the A2RYY, A2RYY's up here in the tech net.
Hi, Dick. Yes, I did run some experiments with one of these DTV converters, a portable TV, and the amplifier gave me about 20 dB gain, and I didn't use a horizontally polarized at them, but I don't think it really mattered. I don't really mess with the current decoder I have. I tried, actually tried two different decoders. I could not get mobile television at a speed faster than 5 to 10 miles per hour. Anything faster than that, the picture would simply not be there anymore. If you look at the signal meter, you could see it go up and down, searching for the signal, but you could not get a picture that would lock on. And it had nothing to do with the signal strength, absolutely nothing, because I went to various different locations and tried different experimentation. Even as far as went up on Texas 46 in the expressway to 48 on the South Service Road, which is really trying to lock up on the picture, but the picture pixelates tremendously. And that's virtually nothing between myself and the television antenna looking at me to the left. So the current system of these decoders does not work at all in mobile operation. I took the same type of decoder and sat someplace very close to the city. I took it into the city of around Little Lake Parkway, where I could sit someplace and see the station from the air, off the air pretty easily. Even stationary, as vehicles pass by me, they would make the picture break up quite noticeably. And cars, of course, talk about you doing like 20, 30 miles an hour in a car, so 30 miles an hour is like 44 feet per second. Just that kind of signal change by itself was enough to upset the picture. So it makes me wonder, when you're out in the fringes or something like this, how are things going to happen and affect the picture, like simply like having trees and branches on the trees move in a windstorm?
Hey, you know, the EIC for Steve is kind of sensitive to take care of this.
So are you saying, Eric, that the new ESD, the EESD decoders, when they become available, will have a lot more accommodation for the experiment of what Joe just did? Is that what you're saying, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, the problem that he has is that there's a little bit of Doppler that gets in there.